This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In Munich, in 1938, the British and French prime ministers allowed Adolf Hitler to swallow a portion of Czechoslovakia in return for a piece of paper that Neville Chamberlain said guaranteed peace in our time. Ever since, appeasement has been a code word for the folly of compromise with dictators. Earlier this month, President Bush invoked the word in a speech to the Israeli Knesset in Jerusalem in what was widely seen as an attack on the likely Democratic presidential nominee, Barack Obama, who had said, if elected, he would hold unconditional talks with the leaders of rogue states Iran, Syria, Cuba, North Korea, and Venezuela in his first year. Both Democrat Hillary Clinton and Republican John McCain described that as naive. Political rhetoric aside, imagine you are the president. What needs to be considered as you weigh that decision? At what level do you talk, and under what circumstances? Are there certain leaders, certain regimes you would never talk to? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also comment on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later on in the program, we'll talk with two of the real people portrayed by actors in Recount, the HBO movie about the 2000 election in Florida. But first, talking with the enemy. Leslie Gelb is President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. He joins us from the Council on Foreign Relations studio in New York. Nice to have you back on the program.
Afternoon.
And Robert Kaufman is a professor of public policy at Pepperdine University and author of In Defense of the Bush Doctrine. He's with us from Pepperdine University studio in Malibu, California. Nice to speak with you.
Nice to be here.
And I know that one thing you both agree on is that there are few absolutes. There are situations when it's preferable to talk and situations where it may not be. So when, and I guess you raised the question in one of your op-ed pieces, Leslie Gelb, how do we talk to our enemies?
Sure. There are a lot of distinctions to be made. You talk to an enemy, but the first question is, at what level? Do you talk at a diplomatic level? You talk at a ministerial level or presidential level? What's the conversation about? Is it wide-ranging? Is it focused on a particular problem? And then, you know, beyond just talking, there's the question of whether you're willing to compromise or make concessions. And, you know, those are things that lie down the road once you see what's really going on. And the prime purpose of the diplomatic contact is to give you a much better sense of what's going on. Now, there are a lot of people who say, well, that doesn't give you such a good sense, and you're legitimizing the bad guys. But I think I hardly know a professional diplomat here or in any other country who don't feel it's to our advantage in terms of gaining information and in terms of applying American power to have those diplomatic contacts. What we do beyond them is another matter.
Robert Kaufman, let me bring you into this and ask, for example, the Bush administration, not known for its friendliness with the axis of evil, yet was in contact for many years with Libya, not in public, though, but finally in negotiations that resulted in Libya's abandonment of its nuclear weapons program.
Well, Leslie Gelb is right in a general way. Whether you talk to a nation or not depends on the circumstances. It also depends on the level and what the purpose is. It's also useful on many occasions to talk to your enemies. There are, however, some enemies and some circumstances that overcome that presumption, and negotiations become harmful rather than helpful. Let me quote Clausewitz, who said that war is a continuation of politics by other means. Some regimes regard negotiations as war by other means.
And so what kinds of circumstances, for example, governments say we never negotiate with hostage takers, we never negotiate with terrorists, yet we know that at least privately in some circumstances, most of the time they do.
Well, you said the key word in that circumstance, privately. And even then, it's problematic, as President Reagan found out in the 80s, negotiating with Iran and other terrorist organizations for hostages. Let me cut to the chase. I would not negotiate with this current Iranian regime at a public level under these circumstances.
Leslie Gelb, what about you? Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the prime minister of Iran, is well known as somebody who's threatened the existence of the state of Israel and denies the Holocaust.
Well, I would negotiate with this Iranian government because they are the Iranian government. And who else is in favor of doing that? Well, last time I looked, It was Defense Secretary Bob Gates, former Secretary of State Jim Baker, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. And lo and behold, President George W. Bush himself, he's negotiated with them on lots of fronts, including several meetings at the ambassadorial level regarding Iraq. And we had contacts with the Iranians when we cooperated with them in fighting the Taliban in Afghanistan. So Bush himself is prepared to deal with Iran. You can't go around preventing necessary diplomatic contacts, which is a way of finding out what's going on and applying American power by calling anybody who would do that an appeaser. Because even the toughest-minded presidents, if you want to call Reagan and Bush the toughest-minded, they did it and they do it.
Robert Kaufman, in the context of Afghanistan, yes, the Bush administration did talk to the Iranians.
But that's not quite a fair portrayal of it. The issue is at what level, and the issue is do you fully engage the Iranian regime as both the Baker Commission and Senator Obama proposes? In that particular case, I think the answer is no, because the Iranian regime is trying to use the negotiation process as a way of tranquilizing us to the gathering danger of their nuclear program.
When you meet their ambassador in Baghdad, you are engaging the Iranian regime. When you work with them to fight the Taliban in Afghanistan, you're engaging the whole Iranian regime. That's a distinction without a difference.
No, it isn't. Senator Obama is saying that you engage in negotiations without conditions, and Ronald Reagan never did that, especially with the Soviet Union.
He certainly did.
No, he didn't. The Soviet Union came back to the table under his conditions.
One at a time,
no,
Leslie
Gelb. It's just not
so. Yes, he did.
I covered that on a daily basis for the New York Times at the time. And Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev had very free-floating negotiations. In fact, they both went beyond the briefs prepared by their staffs.
In Reykjavik, in Iceland. I was there.
Yes, sure.
That's after Gorbachev met Reagan's conditions. No, it isn't. I just finished the Reagan diaries, and until Gorbachev came to power, Ronald Reagan established conditions for resuming the arms negotiations with the Soviet Union. He was right. He did not negotiate unconditionally.
It just didn't happen that way.
Look at the archives.
Well, as we get into this dispute over history, nevertheless, I don't think anybody's talking about going into negotiations unprepared without the so-called Sherpas working their way towards a summit.
There's something
to talk about that everybody knows they're going to be talking about once they get to the meeting.
Of course not. Look, part of the bargaining process is to try to get conditions before you start bargaining. And, you know, we tried to do that with the Chinese in the early Nixon-Kissinger contacts. We wanted to get them to accept the fact that we're going to continue to support Taiwan, and they wanted us to dump Taiwan even before the negotiations started. But eventually we agreed to negotiations without preconditions. It's essentially the same deal we made with Gaddafi. With one caveat, that is, we did make clear to him we wouldn't sign anything unless he compensated the victims of the Lockerbie terrorist attack.
Robert Kaufman, let me ask you about that Chinese example, because then the regime of Mao Zedong, this was not quick, it was not unconditional, it was not easy negotiation. Nevertheless, this was, one of the great monsters of the 20th century.
This is why you do negotiate even with your adversaries most of the time. By the late 1960s, it was apparent that the Sino-Soviet split gave the Chinese an incentive despite our differences, so that it was plausible to think that there were areas where we could negotiate even though we had differences. There are, however, categories of regimes, and I think Iran is one of them. There are categories of entities. Hamas is another one, where their goals are so implacable that negotiating with them actually is more dangerous than not negotiating, because you legitimize them if you do negotiate.
And though
did John McCain legitimize Hamas when he said after their election that, you know, you probably would have to engage them in negotiations? Was that appeasement too?
John McCain will not negotiate with Hamas until Hamas
got elected.
If you look at McCain's campaign statements, he will not negotiate with Hamas, nor with Mrs. Clinton, until Hamas recognizes Israel's right to exist. I agree with them.
Leslie Gelb, is there a difference with these non-state actors? I don't think either of you would recommend negotiating, for example, with Al-Qaeda.
No, I wouldn't negotiate with Al-Qaeda, even on a prisoner exchange or release of prisoners, because I think they really are beyond the pale. If the stated aim of the supposed negotiating partner is to eliminate you, there's nothing much to talk about.
And, well, isn't that the situation if you have a government in this country which talks about regime change? What's the interest of the Iranians in talking to us?
Well, they don't think they have much interest in talking to us as long as they believe that that is our real goal. And look, we can say that's our real goal, and Bush more or less proclaimed that publicly, and we see the result of it. The result is Iran went from being just another power in that part of the world to being a major and feared power. They're causing us great problems in Iraq. They're moving toward uranium enrichment. And I don't see where shutting them out and talking about a regime change weakened them. In fact, it strengthened them.
Using Mr. Gelb's language, beyond the pale, that's where Iran is. If you look at what President Ahmadinejad has said repeatedly, the Holocaust didn't happen, it shouldn't happen, he wants it to happen, and he sees Anglo-American civilization as the root cause of the problem. Iran, in my opinion, and Senator McCain's, is a regime that falls beyond that pale.
We're talking with Robert Kaufman. He's the professor of public policy at Pepperdine University, author of In Defense of the Bush Doctrine, and with Leslie Gelb, president emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. If you'd like to get involved in the conversation, what risks and benefits should the president weigh before opening negotiations with rogue regimes? At what level? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's becoming a hot issue on the campaign trail. Should the next president meet with Cuba's Raul Castro or open a dialogue with Iran's Mahmoud Ahmadinejad? Republican Senator John McCain accuses Democratic Senator Barack Obama of being reckless and naive for suggesting unconditional talks with the leaders of rogue regimes. We're talking about when and how we should talk with the bad guys. Our guests are Leslie Gelb, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. Also with us is Robert Kaufman, Professor of Public Policy at Pepperdine University. We'd like to involve you in the conversation. If you were president, when would you talk to your enemies, under what circumstances, and are there certain regimes, certain leaders you would never talk to? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Chuck. Chuck with us from San Francisco.
Thanks very much. I'm concerned that by not talking to Iran, for instance, in some ways we're playing into their hands, because I think Ahmadinejad is trying to increase Iran's influence in the region and set themselves up as kind of the alternative to the regimes that are widely seen as overly influenced by the U.S. and to portray us as bent on military domination. And if we seem unwilling to engage this very significant constituency out in that part of the world politically and are only seen as wanting military engagement, then to some extent we strengthen his characterization of us and thereby increase his influence.
Robert Kaufman?
Why does Ahmadinejad want to talk to us? And he does. Why did he want to go to the Columbia University campus and talk? He did.
He seems like...
Chuck, hold on. Let the answer go ahead.
My answer is that he is using negotiations as a strategy to legitimize his regime, disarm us, and undermine a strong, effective response. Given what I think Iran's intentions are, I agree with Senator McCain. The only thing worse than potentially using force against Iran, if it comes to that, is allowing this regime to get nuclear weapons. Ahmadinejad is using negotiations to tranquilize us to the gathering danger of his nuclear program, which is why I would not negotiate with him publicly.
I'd like to answer your first question very directly in saying I think he would probably like to at least claim to want to talk, because that, in some ways, it fits in with what I just said. It portrays him as perhaps the more flexible, the more reasonable party. And to talk does not mean to legitimize. to talk means you are willing to engage in something other than war by military means, which is to say you're willing to engage in a political process. And I think if we demonstrated that willingness, it would undermine his position with a very significant constituency in that part of the world.
Yeah, I understand the argument, but I see it going the other way.
Leslie Galbi.
It's very hard for me to follow this because, you know, to say Ahmadinejad is doing this stuff to disarm us, we're not so stupid. President George W. Bush is not going to disarm, nor are the people running for president today. They're not so foolish. When Ahmadinejad does things, it doesn't mean we have to concede to him. We're trying to use our power through these diplomatic means. Now, you know, take this distinction without a difference that the professor is making. He says, well, it's all right if we talk to their ambassador in Baghdad, but we can't talk to Ahmadinejad. Well, when we talk to the ambassador in Baghdad, it's with Ahmadinejad's approval. And everybody understands that. Besides, there isn't a government in that part of the world that does not want the United States to talk to Iran, except for Israel. All the others want us to engage. And when we don't, it looks like we're fearful of doing so. And who embraced Ahmadinejad more than anybody else in the region? The prime minister of the country we're fighting and dying for, Prime Minister al-Maliki of Iraq. He greeted Ahmadinejad in Baghdad like a visiting friend and potentate.
It's not a distinction without a difference. We have used the French and the German method of negotiation for several years, and under cover of those negotiations, the Iranians have accelerated their nuclear program, which is what they intend to do by negotiating. Western European governments are looking for any excuse to avoid confronting the gathering danger.
Sean, I don't want to give it to them. I thought George Bush was threatening them and sending the naval task forces off their coast, and they still went ahead with their nuclear program. I don't see that the threats worked at all.
Yeah,
they're still going forward.
Can I just say that I think that by posing ourselves as an existential threat to, for example, Iran, in some ways we legitimize their nuclear program, don't you think?
There's an assumption in that response that if we weren't doing this, the Iranians would not be pursuing that. I think the evidence is to the contrary.
What's the evidence?
Chuck, I think we're going to have to give somebody else a chance, but thanks very much for the phone call. Here's a blog comment from James. If you look at the record of diplomacy, some of the obvious successes were by right-wing American presidents. Nixon's opening to China, Reagan's sweeping disarmament treaties. When Republicans criticize talking, they should look to some of the best examples of negotiations, examples led by their own party stalwarts. Also, Olmert is referring, of course, to the Prime Minister of Israel, met with Syria less than a week after that speech. It was revealed that there are indirect talks between Israel and Syria being moderated by the Turkish government. And Syria presents another example, and Syria is a case of a government labeled as one of the state sponsors of terrorism, certainly involved in the support of Hezbollah in Lebanon, and again with Hamas in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank as well. Do we talk to Syria? Leslie Gelb?
Absolutely. But doesn't mean you give things away. You know, Hitler was a devil. And I'd like to believe I would have resisted talking to him personally. But I think the problem was not so much talking to Hitler, who was, after all, Chancellor of Germany, the foremost power in Europe. The problem was that Chamberlain gave him Czechoslovakia. That was the issue. He gave a country away. That was the appeasement. And if we negotiate with Iran or North Korea or Gaddafi, it doesn't mean we have to be as stupid as Chamberlain was in dealing with Hitler.
Chamberlain shouldn't have gone to Munich in the first place, and we have been as stupid. President Clinton reluctantly allowed President Carter to go to North Korea in 1994. The assumption was that those negotiations had yielded a compromise, and everybody knows now that North Korea used those negotiations as a cover for their nuclear program, which they announced brazenly in 2002. The very act of going to North Korea had the public effect of tranquilizing American public opinion to the danger. That happens.
I don't think it tranquilized us at all. It gave us an opportunity to go in there and inspect and to find out that they weren't keeping to the terms of the agreement. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been able to find out at all.
We didn't find out. They announced it in 2002.
No. They did not announce it.
They announced it in the summer of 2002.
It came out after a private negotiation where our Assistant Secretary of State, Kelly, told them in these private talks that we knew that they were doing uranium enrichment programs.
Let's get another caller.
So we paid the money, and they lied, and they confronted us with a fait accompli.
Here's another caller. This is Jarir. Jarir with us from Detroit.
Yes. I have, as a descendant from the Middle East and lived for a long time, it seems like, you know, there's always war and war and one after another. And my question is, if you don't negotiate, is it fair to say that you're pro-war? I mean, are there other options other than negotiation or war? I mean, it's really in is it fair to say that when you fail to negotiate, you're not thinking about so many other lives and souls and people who are going to end up suffering because of war as the only alternative to negotiate? I mean, and is it also possible that when you go for war and you don't negotiate, do you achieve what you want? I mean, is it possible that you think, well, okay, negotiation wouldn't work. What makes you think that war will work? I mean, what's the guarantee that if you go for war, then you're going to succeed?
Neil, this is a good question. It really is.
Leslie, go first, yeah.
Yeah, because no sensible president would ever not do both. That is, you want to negotiate and you want to apply pressure. You want to have both things working for you. You don't want to do just one. For example, President Bush did just one with North Korea. He stopped negotiating. He made threats. He said, if you start testing this, it's unacceptable to the United States. If you have a nuclear explosion, it's unacceptable to the United States. And then they did both those things, and Bush swallowed both. And what it did was to show that our threats were empty, and he weakened American power. See, because he was just doing one.
Let's hear from you, Robert Kaufman.
That's a false dichotomy. The choice is not always between war and negotiation. You can impose conditions. We impose conditions until we negotiated with the Palestinian Liberation Organization. The PLO had to recognize Israel's right to exist. To establish conditions for negotiations rather than negotiations is an intermediate option. Let me say, however, that there are times when using force is indeed the lesser moral and geopolitical evil.
Has the PLO ever changed the charter and recognized Israel's right to exist?
No, they never did, Neil. To the very end, when Arafat died, they still hadn't changed the charter. And the Israelis and we bitched about it all the time, as we should have, because he promised he would do it, but he never did, and we kept on talking to him.
We claimed that he did change the charter, even though he didn't.
Claim all you want.
Yeah, that's. But getting back to Jarir's question,
that's even worse. We made a claim in his behalf.
Getting back to
the administration, hid behind the claim.
Getting back to Jarir's question, though, there are other alternatives: isolation, containment, as was the case in the case of the Kennan Doctrine of the Soviet Union after the Second World War and during the first stages of the Cold War. Aren't those options between negotiations and open or indirect conflict?
Those options involve in many cases negotiations. Sometimes they don't. It depends on the circumstances and the enemy.
Well, we surely want to contain Iran, but Iran now has spread its influence into Iraq, into Lebanon, into the Gaza Strip. Under this get-tough policy, this phony get-tough policy, Iran has become a regional superpower.
We're talking. Thanks very much for the call, Jarir. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And our guests are Leslie Gelb of the Council on Foreign Relations, where he's president emeritus, and Robert Kaufman of the Pepperdine University, where he's a professor of public policy. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And Ali is on the line. Ali calling from Denver in Colorado.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I wanted to express my support for Mr. Kaufman's position. Having been born and raised in Iran, Mullahs proved to the world that Iran is the inventor of the game chess. They're playing a chess game. They're forcing America to react to their actions, and we need to destroy their nuclear facilities so that we can sit down and negotiate with them from the position of power. Otherwise, we'll have to go sit at that table, and I do agree we need to negotiate with them, but only from the position of power, because that's the only language that they understand, and they're very cunning. So it's foolish to think that, as he mentioned, Mr. Kaufman mentioned, it's a false dichotomy. We can negotiate once we have proven that we mean it and we have power on our side.
Leslie Gelb, are we in a losing game of chess with Iran?
I think what I said, I may have been unclear, I think I said you have to do both. You have to negotiate and apply the pressure. It is foolish to just do one. And in the case of the Iranians, they should always be worried about an American military option. I wouldn't take that off the table at all.
And what do you do, and thanks for the call, Ali, what do you do when you're in negotiations with North Korea about them eliminating their nuclear weapons program, and at the same time you discover they're apparently building a nuclear reactor in Syria so that Syria can develop a nuclear weapons program?
You encourage the Israelis to blow it up, as we did.
And Leslie Gelb, is that the right approach?
That didn't bother me at all. I think the Syrians and the North Koreans and others in the area should be aware of the consequences of such overt acts. And where we can do it at reasonable cost, I'm for it. But as far as going to war with Iran is concerned, I didn't notice President Bush backing up all his threats and starting a war with Iran. He made the threats. He didn't back them up. Iran gained in power in the region. And I want to play a power politics game, but he played it, and he's losing it.
Mr. Gelb began by defending Senator Obama's statement about unconditional negotiations. He wants to withdraw from Iraq as well. Where is the pressure on Iran? I see the negotiations part, but where is the negotiations coupled with diplomatic pressure under the framework that Senator Obama has laid out? I don't see it, nor do his critics.
Well, I haven't seen it from President Bush, and I haven't seen it from Senator McCain. This is a campaign, and they make statements. Sometimes they stick by them. Sometimes they amend them, and they'll amend them even more if they get elected.
I saw Senator McCain here, and Senator McCain said in Los Angeles on March 26th, the only thing worse than this Iranian regime using force against it is to allow it to get nuclear weapons. That's a categorical statement. I think he means
Bush it. Bush made the same categorical statement, that they're going forward with their uranium enrichment program was unacceptable. But then what did he do? He accepted it. So, if you want to complain about not backing up tough words in order to maintain credibility, in order to maintain American power, your criticism is correctly directed at Bush himself. And as far as, hanging a lot on what McCain said yesterday or Obama said 2 weeks ago, you and I know we shouldn't do that too much.
Campaign rhetoric does not always prove to be White House policy.
It's very likely in McCain's case.
Yeah, he's changed his mind dozens upon dozens of times on important issues in his career, including on George Bush himself, where he's made the most devastating criticisms of Bush's conduct of the war early on, and where they came together on the surge. So, look, that's the business of politics, and let's not pretend otherwise.
It's not pretending. McCain has been committed to victory from day one, and to the extent he's criticized Bush, it is for his inability to win it, not the concept itself.
And Robert Kaufman, you're going to get the last word because we're out of time, but thank you, gentlemen, both for your time today.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. Robert Kaufman of Pepperdine University, Leslie Gelb, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Here's my last word.
Thank you very much.
Darn, you got it.
Yes, I
think I actually get the last word. Coming up, reliving the recount, we'll talk with Ben Ginsberg and Mitchell Berger. Both were portrayed in HBO's movie about the endgame of the 2000 election. We'll get their reviews of the HBO production about how their actor portrayers looked on TV. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.